This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to a new year of Radio EcoShock. 2012 promises to be anything but dull.
You know, every major global recession has had oil's fingerprints all over it. And, you know, once again, when we saw triple-digit oil prices, it's not that those triple-digit oil prices couldn't bring new supply, because it will, but, of course, the economy collapsed.
The price of oil hits you at the pump, in your food bill, and everything you buy. What if you can't afford it? For years, I've covered peak oil as the story of a limited resource. Meanwhile, the oil industry, glutted with billions of dollars in profits, keeps drilling deeper offshore, finds more dirty oil in the tar sands, and will risk the fragile Arctic if we let them. Economist Jeff Rubin says we have hit a new kind of peak oil, the peak price our civilization can pay and still grow. We've passed that point now, Rubin says. If China and India grow, Western countries must shrink, and shrinking isn't pretty. Expect unemployment, disappointed dreams, and governments drowning in debt they can never repay. Who is Rubin? He was the chief economist at CIBC World Markets, a global-scale bank trading operation. As a forward thinker on energy issues, Jeff Rubin gets a lot of press and TV appearances. His 2009 book, Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, shook up the financial world. He predicts an end to globalization and a return to regional production due to the rising costs of oil. We will hear Jeff Rubin's presentation at ASPO 2011. Then you'll get the main clips from a talk by Charles T. Maxwell. He is the senior energy analyst for Wieden Company. Charlie's been a top-ranked energy authority for years. But neither of these gurus include the challenge and damage of climate change in their forecasts. They don't mention it. Why not? To wrap up that angle, we'll finish off the show with a Radio EcoShock interview with Ugo Bardi. He's a crossbreed. As a founder of Aspo Italy and an editor at the oildrum.com blog, but also as part of the Italian climatologist scene. I'll ask Ugo why these two camps don't talk much to each other. Jeff Rubin, Charlie Maxwell, Ugo Bardi, peak oil, climate change, your coming year, all in this edition of Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Let's get busy. Jeff Rubin was recorded at the 2011 Conference of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, or ASPO, in Washington, D.C., on November 4, 2011, by Radio EcoShock correspondent Jerry Williams.
Well, thanks very much. I guess our session is called, What Does the Post-Peak World Look Like? But before discussing that, I guess we have to define exactly what do we mean by peak. Certainly, my definition of peak is probably very different than the majority of people who are in this room. Peak has traditionally been about production, and I guess some of the problems of getting mainstream to accept the notion of peak is that people have drew lines in the sand before at world production or U.S. production or whatever will be X, and then the oil industry goes X plus Y. Now, some, you know, people will say, hey, that's, you know, it's got a declining energy rate of return. Hey, that's got a different energy density. Hey, that's really not oil in the sense that Hubbard understood oil. But, you know, for someone like me, I don't really care. If you can burn it, it's good enough for me, and probably for most folk as well. So what do I think peak is? You see, I think we set the bar too low when it comes for what our expectations of what the energy industry can provide, because it's all about production. And the energy industry is very good at increasing production. But that's not really the issue. It doesn't matter if there's 170 billion barrels of oil trapped in the Canadian tar sands or in the Orinoco heavy oil belt. What matters is how much of that oil we can afford to burn. And that's a whole other ballgame. Because the energy industry isn't nearly as good as producing fuel that we can afford to burn as opposed to just increasing fuel.
And let's look at where we are today. I mean, oil prices are $100 a barrel if you average WTI and Brent, over 100 if you look at the world price, which is Brent. And guess what? There's a lot of oil flowing. I mean, I'll take the resource that I'm probably the most familiar with because I'm Canadian and I know about the Canadian tar sands. $20 a barrel, you can't give that stuff away. At $100 a barrel, you know, you're producing 1.5 million barrels a day, probably en route to 3 million barrels a day. At $200 a barrel, you can probably crank out, I don't know, 5 to 6 million barrels a day out of the stuff. But really, that may be of interest to geologists. It's certainly not of interest to me, and it's certainly probably of little interest to consumers of oil, because the question is, at what price? So when I think of peak oil, I don't think of it as a geological phenomenon. I think of it as an economic phenomenon. And the soul of all economics is one word, price. If you can't afford to burn it, it doesn't matter what kind of resources are in the ground. I mean, after all, as Charlie will tell you, that's the difference between a resource and a reserve. I'd say, for all intent and purposes, we're basically at the peak, at my kind of peak, because my peak isn't about production. My peak is about prices and the impact that those prices have on our ability to consume further fuel. In other words, the peak is not how much we can drill, because I think that the supply curve is upward sloping, and whether it's tar sands or oil shale or deep water Arctic, if you give oil companies a high enough oil price, they'll find it. The peak, rather, is not what we can drill, but what we can consume. So the question we got to ask is, does the world economy operate at these prices? And can it operate at the prices that will bring future supply? And I think the empirical record on that is no. It's extremely problematic. I won't repeat last year's speech, but you know, every major global recession has had oil's fingerprints all over it. And, you know, once again, when we saw triple-digit oil prices, it's not that those triple-digit oil prices couldn't bring new supply, because it will, but, of course, the economy collapsed. Where do we stand now going forward? Well, we see a world burdened in unprecedented debt. And the key reason the world is unprecedented debt is, how did we get out of the last oil-induced recession? We had a coordinated fiscal stimulus of the type that we have never seen in the post-war period. And not just talking about America. I'm talking about basically every major oil-consuming economy in the world. Well, if you ask your government, or if you ask the government of Greece, or you ask the government of Italy how they're going to get out of their deficits, they'll tell you they're going to grow their way out of the deficits. Because if you can't grow your way out of deficits, the size of those deficits today, if you have to take direct fiscal action like Greece is having to take, guess what? Your economy is shrinking. The Greek economy shrank 5% for the last 2 years, and it will continue to shrink. And that's the problem. And, of course, in shrinking the economy, you shrink its tax base. And those fiscal austerity measures, instead of improving a country's deficit, actually worsen the deficit, because the impact on tax revenue is far greater than the impact of any expenditure cuts that you might make. So my take on the debt, just like my take on peak may be a little bit different than yours, my take on the debt is a little bit different than maybe what your government thinks, what the European Monetary Union thinks, because, well, all that debt is denominated in dollars or euros. It might as well be denominated in barrels of oil, because if we're expecting economic growth to be the solution to get the debt GDP level down, to get the deficit GDP level down, we're going to have to be burning a whole lot more oil than we're already burning. Now, already the world economy is burning something like 32 billion barrels a year. And at $100 a barrel, that's $3.2 trillion. I wouldn't deny for a moment that the oil industry couldn't find us more than 32 billion barrels a year, maybe 64 million barrels a year. The only question is, we can't seem to even afford to pay $3.2 trillion for oil. How are we going to pay more? So as I say, all that debt that's denominated in dollars is really denominated in oil. Well, that raises a very interesting question. If we can't grow our way out of these deficits are more or less here to stay, or it's going to take very draconian action to reduce them. And I might say that in this country, you haven't even begun the process of unwinding those fiscal deficits. And the problem, of course, is that unwinding those fiscal deficits result in an economy that is no longer growing.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a speech by former CIBC chief economist Jeff Rubin at the ASPO 2011 Peak Oil and Gas Conference.
So, what does a static economy look like? Because I think what we're looking at is a static economy. Unlike previous oil shocks that were transient price shocks, like the OPEC oil shocks, or 91 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and oil prices doubled, this is not really an oil shock. Nobody's turned off the spigot. In fact, as the oil industry will point out, there's more flowing through it than ever before. It's just that no one can afford the market clearing prices anymore. So, you know, if this is now a permanent state of triple-digit oil prices, and I think it is, because the only time then we saw oil prices collapse is when the world economy collapsed, and that indeed could happen again. But if we cancel out the oscillations of oil-induced recessions and then energy-starved and aborted recoveries, we're basically looking at something that more or less resembles a static economy. That's pretty challenging. You know, one of the speakers yesterday talked about an index of human happiness. I'm not an index of human happiness type of guy, okay? I think static economies generally make people unhappy. And let me just tell you, some of the challenges of a static economy in a developed world, which will be a fraction of the challenges in the developing world. The first thing that you notice when economies don't grow is folk don't have jobs. And that usually registers at the top of the political agenda. Where is the jobless rate going to be in the United States if the U.S. economy stops growing? We could see that even temporary disruptions of growth put the jobless rate double what it was 10 years ago, at 9 to 10%. That's going to be pretty vexing. I suspect the immediate solution will be on closing borders. And, you know, just as my first book talked about triple-digit oil prices resulting in deglobalization because distance costs money and transit costs soon dwarf, in many industries, the wage arbitrage of moving your factories to India and China, I suspect the next issue is closing borders. And, you know, that's a major change, at least in the country that I come from, in this country. I mean, economies like Canada and the U.S. were built on immigration and continue to be built on immigration. I guess our advantage over the developing countries, and a couple of people have asked questions about population, is that we have sub-replacement birth rates, which means that our population's not growing, which certainly takes a lot of pressure off the job creation numbers. However, our populations are growing with immigration, and will we be open to immigration in a closed economy is a very interesting question. What will government look like in the future? I suspect government will look very different than government looks today. Not only is the prospect of further fiscal stimulus out of the question, which begs the question,
In our next oil-induced recession, which the way Brent is going won't be too long, where will the fiscal wherewithal be for coordinated fiscal stimulus in the G7, G8, or G20 when every member country is already hauling debt loads the largest they've been in the post-war period? Obviously, governments will not play the same role in economic stimulation they have in the past, and it really won't matter what part of the ideological spectrum you come from, whether you're a Keynesian interventionist or if you're a monetarist market guy. There just won't be that fiscal option. But above and beyond that, I think that we're going to find that the kind of services that governments will be able to provide are going to be very different when a tax base is not growing. I can give you a couple examples of places where I live, how things are changing. You used to get your license renewal sticker from a transportation ministry where there'd be some civil servant who's getting paid $60,000 a year to give it to you. Now you go into Canadian Tire, which is a big merchandiser in Toronto, and you get the same license sticker from some store clerk on minimum wage. And it's not that I think citizens want to fire public servants, but I think when given the choice between having a government service delivered to you through subcontracting through the private sector and having no government service delivered because it can no longer pay the costs, we're going to choose subcontracting out to the private sector. Not because the private sector is any more efficient than the government sector. I think that's more an ideological position than anything else, but because the private sector can do it a lot cheaper. What will consumer look like? I mean, when you talk about an economy that's basically no longer growing, two-thirds of our economy is consumer spending. If all of a sudden consumer spending stops growing, I mean, that's a whole other world that, you know, I think is very fundamentally different than the world that we've known. What about our trade sectors? I think that what we're going to find is that our economies are going to become much more inward-looking, that trade is going to become increasingly regionalized or balkanized because, as I said in my presentation last year, distance is costing money. And already we're seeing shifts. We're seeing shifts in that, you know, what's driving China's economic growth is no longer exports to Walmart because Walmart sales, if it was, China's economic growth wouldn't be any more impressive than Walmart sales or U.S. consumer spending is. And I guess on that point, I'd like to throw out something that I think is probably very fundamental to the future of this economy here in the United States. You know, we all look at what's happening in Europe, and we all look at the problems of financing a Greece and maybe problems of financing a Spain or financing Italy. Your deficit isn't that much smaller than Greece's as a proportion to your GDP. And while Greece is relying on their allies and their European partners to finance them, and it remains to be seen how long they'll do that, who are you relying on? You're relying on your archenemy. You're relying on the People's Bank of China to finance you. And they're not financing you for the sake of lessening your tax burden. They're financing you because they still think that we're in an expanding world economy where energy is cheap and the U.S. market is the engine for their economic growth. Well, I think in the new world you're going to find two very important reasons why China will not be financing the U.S. Treasury. First of all, China's most vexing problem, as is India's most vexing problem, is inflation. And if you look at inflation rates are around over 6% in China, pushing up around 10% in India. If you look at what's pushing up those inflation rates, two things, imported food, imported oil. What are those prices denominated in? Those prices are denominated in U.S. dollars. The easiest way that China can put a lid on rising inflation of food and energy prices is to appreciate the yuan against the U.S. dollar.
And if we look at the adjustment between the yen and the U.S. dollar during the 70s, one can easily see as much as a 40 to 50% appreciation. A 40 to 50% appreciation of the Chinese yuan against the U.S. dollar has very different effects on the price of oil in the United States and the price of oil in China, because that move in the exchange rate would dwarf any subsidies that either China or India give to its oil-consuming public. And what does that mean? It means that oil becomes more accessible to the Chinese economy and less accessible to the U.S. economy. And in a world of basically zero-sum growth, in a world where maybe we won't see market clearing oil production much higher than where we are, that's not just basically an inflation problem, that's a growth problem. In other words, the more that China grows, the less the OECD grows. Hence, if oil is driving economic growth, a redistribution in oil consumption results in a redistribution of global growth. So, to conclude, I want to say that, you know, all those ramifications that we think may lie just around the corner once we cross some critical oil production threshold, guess what? We've already crossed that threshold, because the threshold is not production, the threshold is price, and we are now in a world of triple-digit oil. And in that world, all of the economic consequences that we're postulating we have to face in 3 to 4 years, we're already facing. We're in a zero-sum world, which means that if other economies grow because they have greater access to energy, then some other economies must stop growing. Thanks very much.
That was former CIBC chief economist and well-known energy analyst Jeff Rubin. He was recorded at ASPO 2011 in Washington by Radio EcoShock correspondent Jerry Williams. My thanks to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, for permission to broadcast this speech. We move on to one of the heavyweights of the energy investment business, Charles Maxwell. He's the senior energy analyst for Wieden Company. Charlie is a legend in peak oil circles. Due to time limitations, I've selected two key parts of his presentation. After his talk about when peak oil might strike, Maxwell explains where our future oil might come from. Then I'll deliver his conclusion of austerity and joy. Here is Charles Maxwell, recorded at ASPO 2011 on November 4th.
And Jeff was very good, I thought, on his cost thesis, and I do agree with it completely, just as he said it. But I think that peak oil, I want to come back to this subject of defining peak oil, because I think it's really going to turn out to be quite different than we think it is. I think it's a geologic effect, I think it's a demographic effect, and I think it's a cost effect. And I'm not sure that there aren't going to be a political effect before we're finished. Demographic, because there's simply too many people in the world. We're treated just to this sensitivity to demographics in the last week or so, because it has been decided by the UN that at the end of this year, this is 7 billion is what we have now. But I think you understand, you've seen these numbers, that to go forward with a billion people, it was something, it took us up to something like 1790 before we had the first billion. And then after that, it was about 100 years before we had the second billion. And now it's less and less and less every billion that we hit, and this last billion was something like 24 years. This is extraordinary, and we are thus increasing our numbers so fast that we don't have a hope of solving the problem of a resource that is finite like this, that we're using a lot of, and that we need to continue to increase using infinitely as our population expands. It just can't be done. It's a non-starter. It's unsustainable. So the issue is not which direction we're going, but simply when we get there. This, I think, is the most interesting chart that I have. It's nothing more than just a look at who has peaked. Russia has to be looked at carefully, because the old Soviet Union will not do, And we've subtracted out Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan and all of that, so that the peak of 11.4 does represent the peak of production in what is now Mother Russia. But we're not anywhere near that. I mean, we're at about 10.3, and we're stabilizing out. I think that the top for Russia will be about 10.5. Now, they could go a lot higher. Geologically, they could go a lot higher. But the way they're organized, the way that they're financed, the number of engineers that they can produce, the amount of technological help that they're willing to import from abroad, really tens of factors added together, suggests that their practical peak will be something around 10.5 or 10.6. I think as they approach 11.4, it would get harder and harder. Now, if there were a change of regime, I'd have to change my estimates, because if you said, geologically speaking, Charlie, how high could they go, I would guess 13 or 14 million barrels a day. But just the way that they're organized, it doesn't look like they can. Mexico, of course, is the most dramatic in recent years in terms of its drop, and it is stabilizing. But I think you may understand that this meteor that came in about 64 million years ago hit about 25 miles northwest of the city of Progreso, which is the port for Merida in the Yucatan. And it's still out there, buried deep, and it set off a nuclear winter that we estimate was 5 or 6 years, and that wiped out the food chain, and that killed off something like 80% of the number of species that were then existent in the world. Out of this terrible time of carnage, the mammal assumed dominance of the world from the dinosaurs. It was beautifully depicted in music in Fantasia that some of you may remember, the death of the dinosaurs. It rubbleized the Yucatan, and you can see that if you go there on vacation, look for it. It's all over the place. It's the sea bottom brought up here that is the peninsula of the Yucatan. And water, when it rains, goes right down those cracks. And it's that rubble that is out there that is such a good storage for oil. So easy in and easy out turns out to be the particular problem. It isn't a geological problem that one sees very much. But that storage out there at Cantarell is just a remarkable storehouse, because it is rubbleized rock, which is perfect as a storage for oil. So they now understand why it was such a powerful producer and why now it won't do very much more. So we're back to square one. Mexico can slowly grow if they have an organization that will allow them to do that. They don't, and they won't replace it for political reasons. So they're stuck at about where they are, and they won't be able to help us very much. Norway still has some more. The UK does not have very much more. Argentina still has some more potential growth, but not that much to get back to its old highs. Of these, Colombia looks like it's the only one that will actually be able to, by a political change that's occurring there, the defeat of the guerrilla movement, that they're able to get back to old highs and pass them. Generally, when you go down, you go down for the count.
We'll move on to the conclusion of this speech at ASPO 2011 by Charles Maxwell, a renowned energy analyst.
I think what we're facing is something like a huge cube. A cube has six sides, and the first three sides would be your fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal. Fourth would be a non-fossil fuel, but still a traditional fuel now, nuclear power. Fifth would be the sustainables, the renewables, the biotechs, and the biological fuels, the solar and geothermal and wind power and hydro. Hydro is most of that, and I think you all understand that photovoltaics and wind are so small that they will not make a very substantial contribution in the next 15 to 20 years, simply because they're starting from such a low base. Last of the six, and the most interesting, is what is not a fuel, but it can be treated for measuring purposes as a fuel, and that's energy conservation and efficiency. Conservation implies that you don't use it. And there are not a lot of instances in which you don't want to use it. But there are a lot of instances in which you want to use it, but use it much more efficiently. And we've been talking about, I think Bob Rapier said something about opportunities and being in the investment world. I'm always looking for those opportunities. This will be the great area, in my opinion, for opportunities to invest successfully. In a world absolutely of slower growth, we'll be lucky to have growth, but we'll probably have some small amount of growth. There won't be a lot of industries that are rapidly escalating their ability to earn money and pay dividends and do all those good investment things. Most industries are going to be constrained by these conditions. But the energy efficiency business is going to be huge. Now, there was a question here about how he would be heating New England's homes with heating oil and so on, and what a difficult situation it was, and it is. I've been there and I've seen it. But I am connected with a group that's working on that. And it just happens, it's an interesting example, but there has been some changes and some really a revolution in thinking about heat pumps. And a heat pump is designed to separate active molecules, that is, warm materials, from cold materials, passive molecules. It is amazing what can be done. A refrigerator is a common heat pump. And we're running about a 50% conservation factor. We're able to heat a home for about 50% less energy. And even though we still may need to use natural gas or heating oil, it is incredible to think that it could be done with 50% of the thermal power that we've got. So I think that this area of innovation, in which America is so good, is going to be our Saudi Arabia in the end. The other big factor is going to be natural gas. So we aren't going to do very much in the near term with the renewables. The oil is not really, we're not really able to show incremental growth there. Coal is going to be held back. Nuclear is not going to come in for another 20 years. It's not acceptable yet. And we're not going to do much with it until several more generations have come through, generations of nuclear equipment. So energy efficiency and natural gas are going to be the two great spurs out. Will they be enough? I think the answer is plainly no. So as I do my work, it shows that we're going to be running into energy shortages by 2015, and we're going to have something like 15 years of this tightness encompassing us. Now, that you're suddenly thinking, my God, this is another doom and gloom speech. I really think that we've got to think about this carefully, and I want to leave you with this thought, that happiness is often seen as a question of expectations. And our expectations, not this group, I must say, but the expectations of the American people as a whole, are very high, and there is going to be a period of time in which all of our societies in Europe, Canada, America, Mexico, Latin America, Africa, we're all going to go through a blunting of expectations. It's going to be a hard time because not only are things going to be turning down and turning flat, but we're also going to be disappointed because our dreams are not being met. But to the extent to which our dreams were material, they're probably not that important and not that realizable anyway. But to the extent to which our dreams involve the natural world, it may be that something like going into more gardening for grossly economic reasons has other benefits. I think it does. You know, you're not going to be able to get fruits and vegetables from California so easily, and they're going to be very expensive because of the whole mobility of the world is going to slow down with higher costs. But does that mean that your diet will suffer? Not really. Not necessarily. There are a lot of joys we're going to be capable of enjoying that our grandparents and our great-grandparents enjoyed. I mean, it's not as if people haven't passed through this, what you might call an age of austerity before. It's happened many times. I think many of you know that, just to take a classic example of this surprising outlook that occurs in the midst of problems, the Danish state made a very careful study after Second World War of the deteriorating health situation. This was in the 60s. And they found that the most healthy time for the Danish citizens that they ever enjoyed, the lowest rates of cancer, the lowest rates of cold, the lowest rates of pneumonia, was in the war years, 43, 44, 45. It doesn't surprise you, because when you think about it, you realize why. They didn't have the corrupting influence of liquor and tobacco and and all these things that we, the sweets and the ice cream and the butter and the eggs, the things we really love. But there was tremendous health. And all I want to say is I think we're going into a period of austerity. We think hard about it. There are some real joys to be had there too. Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We've just heard two talks from the concluding day of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, annual conference. This one was in Washington, D.C. in early November 2011. The recordings of Jeff Rubin and Charles Maxwell were made by our Radio EcoShock correspondent, Jerry Williams. Thank you, Jerry. You'll notice neither Rubin or Maxwell mentioned climate change at all, as though extreme weather damages and rising seas are not also major impacts on our economic prospects, as though the world will never limit fossil fuel production because we are wrecking the climate for all foreseeable time. Jeff Rubin, I know, does acknowledge climate change, but it is absent here. Why? We'll now go to our feature interview for this week. From Florence, Italy, it's an honor to speak with Ugo Bardi. We often wonder which comes first and which is worst, climate change or peak oil, but this may not even be the right question. To help sort this out, we're going to Italy to talk with Ugo Bardi. He is a professor of chemistry at the University of Firenze, that is Florence. Ugo is a rare bridge in two worlds. He is the founder of ASPO Italy, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. Ugo is a contributor and member of the editorial board of the Oil Drum blog and has published two books in Italian on oil depletion. But Bardi is also a member of an association of Italian climatologists. His latest book in English is The Limits to Growth Revisited, published in 2011 by Springer. Ugo Bardi, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Well, Ugo, I've been following peak oil for years, interviewing people like Richard Heinberg and James Howard Kunstler, and of course I speak with climate scientists, but it's very seldom I find anyone to talk about both. Why is this?
Well, I'm not the only one who can speak about both issues, but you're right, it's not so easy. There is a divide, there is a frontier in between the people who deal with peak oil, who are concerned about peak oil, and people who are more concerned about climate change. I think I could tell you a story, and it goes back to 2003 when I went to attend my first peak oil conference in Paris, and that was all new for me, this story of peak oil, and it was new for me and for many people who came to listen to this conference, to these speakers about oil, about these great geologists who had invented this idea that oil was going to, I mean, not to run out, but to become difficult to extract. So there was a reaction. I remember it very well. People said, well, what is that? It's if we are being fighting so much about climate change, then these people come up with this idea of peak oil, and then it's going to ruin everything, because if we are going to run out or anyway not have enough oil, then what's the point of worrying about climate change? So there has been, from that time, there has been a conflict in between the two sides of the problem. And that makes a little bit difficult to find people who have the same interest or competency, or anyway they have been trying to explore both issues. But let me tell you that this is changing. I think it's going to change very rapidly and very soon, because people who have been working with peak oil are discovering that climate change is a very serious problem, probably more serious than peak oil. And climatologists are beginning, a bit slowly I'd say, but to understand there is a problem with depletion. So the scenarios, the calculation about what's going to happen, must take into account the fact that we are not going to burn oil all the way to the end of the 21st century. As they say, normally we do this calculation and tell us, okay, by 2100 we're going to have 6-8 degrees of increase in temperature, but we are not going to be able to burn as much oil as many people think. But the problem remains very serious because we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but the two problems are a mirror of each other.
Right. Well, let's go back to March 2009. You wrote an important article in the Oil Drum blog called Fire or Ice, The Role of Peak Fossil Fuels in Climate Change Scenarios. And you did begin with an important point. Climatologists, and especially the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, were assuming that we could fill the sky infinitely with carbon as though supplies will never run out. Do you think the IPCC is aware of the problem of peak oil?
As I said, it is changing, but slowly. They still are locked a little bit to this kind of calculation they have been doing for years. So they are not going right now to include peak oil in their calculation, as far as I understood, because the new report from IPCC is going to come out soon, and so we will see what they say in this regard. But let me repeat the point. The uncertainty is so high that we cannot exclude that even with the limited amounts of oil and other fossil fuels that peak oil scenarios imply, even that may be very dangerous in terms of climate change.
Well, back in 2009, when you reviewed the small amount of literature out there, what did you find?
Well, in 2009, there were several attempts to include peak oil scenarios in the IPCC, or let's say climate scenarios, to make a synthesis of the two ideas, see what comes out. And the results were that, well, of course, you are not going to burn so much oil. So maybe, within some assumptions, what happens is that you go up to a certain level of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, and then you go down because you stop burning, you slow down burning, better said. You slow down, and then natural processes like the oceans absorb this CO2 from the atmosphere, and so you go down, and within some calculations, you arrive to the end of the cycle, more or less unscathed. You're safe and alive, let's say. But I think that all these calculations that I reviewed in 2009 have been made obsolete by something new that's happening. And what's happening is that there is a strong reaction of the fossil fuel industry against peak oil. And that was said. Some people said that, look, what you're doing here, making calculations, you don't take into account that people will start burning dirty fuels when peak oil comes. It probably came in some form. And so what's happening now, what is worrisome and is worrying me a lot, is that in 2010 we have seen an increase in CO2 concentration, in emissions in the atmosphere, which was never seen ever in the past. So that's despite the fact that the oil production is more or less static. We are not producing so much. The economy is not going well, so we are not increasing. The economy is not growing, but CO2 emissions are growing, and very fast. Why that? Because people are running oil over cheap oil, the easy oil, the oil which is not so damaging. And so they're moving to the expensive oil, dirty oil, other sources of liquid fuels like tar sands and coal. You can liquefy or gasify coal. And that means that we are getting less energy, but more CO2. And that's a big problem because that's making all the calculations wrong, which is normally what happens when you deal with the future. You make some models and you think something will happen, but as the future comes, you have to adapt all the time, change and modify. The models are still useful, but you need to follow what happens for real. So the situation right now is very worrisome.
And you also brought up a sticky point. There may be no point in spending billions or trillions to capture carbon for sequestration. You said that in your article, the oil is limited. We may not have to spend money to sequester it.
Yeah, that's possible. What we're doing now, we're spending money into obtaining liquid fuels from dirty sources, which is bad. Then if we were to leave everything go the way, the easy way to oil to run out the way that, let's say, let's nature wanted it to go. I mean, we don't have so much oil. Let's adapt with oil running out. And so that's a strategy that we could have taken. Okay, we could have decided, all right, oil is so expensive, we are just going to use less and concentrate into doing different things like exploiting renewable energy, or even nuclear energy. Some people like that. And that would have been a strategy. In that case, we would not have needed to sequester anything. Just slow down consumption, slow down production. And so we come out of the problem more or less safe. But what we're doing is not that. And right now, with extracting oil from these sources, from these dirty sources, then one possibility would be to sequester it, even though that is expensive.
Ugo, it's not just that climate science is slow to see peak oil. On the other side, it seems some peak oil specialists don't know enough about global warming. This came out last April in a panel discussion at the 9th annual ASPO conference in Brussels. There was a good panel organized by the Club of Rome, and one of the surprises for me was Ian Dunlop of ASPO Australia. He used to represent the coal industry there, and now he's talking about climate change. So we're seeing some crossovers, but there are still people in the peak oil movement who deny climate change is happening or that it's important at all.
A few, yes, still do. There is some new ideas are always difficult to accept, especially for people who spend their life working for the oil industry. They are specialized into prospecting for oil, extracting oil, optimizing oil extraction. It's very difficult for them to accept that what they are doing, they have been doing for older life is bad in absolute terms, because we are damaging the planet and ourselves in the process. But I am very encouraged by what you said, like people who have been working mainly with peak oil, like me. I have been working with peak oil for a long time. Then slowly I came to discover, look, this is a problem, peak oil, of course, but it's very small in comparison to the damage that we can have from climate change. So we need to address climate change with great urgency. And it's a major problem.
And you've just mentioned another big problem, and you raised it in your 2009 article, and that's climate sensitivity. I've just heard a talk by NASA's James Hansen at the 2011 meeting of the American Geophysical Union. As before, Hansen emphasized we've grossly underestimated climate sensitivity. He thinks 350 parts per million may be the tipping point for the Arctic ice. And in the UK, Kevin Anderson is raising similar alarms, and we've just had news out a couple of days ago about Russian scientists finding fountains of methane coming out of Siberia. So I guess my point is, even if we start to run out of affordable oil, nature may take over with positive feedbacks, regardless of our oil supplies. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you mentioned an interesting point, that is fountains of methane in Russia. This is very worrisome, you see, because when we say climate sensitivity, we think that is a nice number that stays constant over time. We can argue how large or how small it is, it's fine. But Hansen especially has been saying, I think correctly, you said, you know, this is the future. And the future is never what you expect. So the future changes, the future always surprises you. And it would be a very bad surprise if we were to see one of these extreme scenarios. Let's call these extreme, because we hope they don't occur, but you never know, because you have this methane which is blowing up from the permafrost, and if that takes over the system, then it is not important anymore how much oil we burn, what we do, what we don't do, what kind of treaties we agree on, where we do a conference, whatever we want to do. It would be an extremely difficult and dangerous situation. So sometimes people say, well, we are not sure about climate change, so we should not do anything. No, it is because we are not sure, that we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And there are some scenarios, as you mentioned, like James Hansen has been proposing these scenarios. It's been said to be an extremist, which maybe is exaggerating. I don't know. But I tell you frankly, honestly, I am a bit scared about these things, because we don't know really what we are doing with this planet.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Ugo Bardi, an Italian professor and author who follows both peak oil and climate change. Ugo, we talked about the separation of experts studying these fields. Now that we're talking about peak oil resources, why don't you tell us about your new book, The Limits to Growth Revisited?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story, that too, because everything that's happening today had been predicted, well, not really predicted, been seen as a possibility back in 1972 with this book, The Limits to Growth, which, as you know, has been very much criticized and even demonized. But now, after almost 40 years from the date of publication, we can see that that book had really caught some very important, some basic facts of our situation right now, because they already had this point, the point you mentioned before, the contrast, apparent contrast for those people worrying about peak oil and those people who worry about climate change. But this dichotomy, this problem was there already in the book in 1972, because they already said, look, there are two main factors which are going to affect the future. One is resource depletion. Depletion is going to cause us problems because we'll run out gradually, slowly, of resources, so the economy is going to suffer. But at the same time, you have the problem of pollution. At that time, they said something about CO2 and global warming, but it was not really known. But they said, okay, there is a problem of the waste to create with industrial activity, and this waste is accumulating. Now we know that it is accumulating in the form of, mainly in the form of carbon dioxide, which is probably going to cause the most damages to our civilization. But already there's a scenario where very easily tweaked from one side to another. We said, okay, we change a little bit the input and we get that the economy is affected mostly by climate change. We change a little bit the parameters and then the economy is affected mainly by depletion. So this is the problem that we have today. Because, as I said, the two problems are a mirror of each other. We are waving in between the two possibilities, that and the two problems, that of solving the problem of depletion and the problem of climate change.
Well, it's likely we're going to suffer through both, isn't it?
Possibly, yes. So it may be that one is much worse than the other. Right now, we cannot say.
Well, you know, countless hours and miles of type have been spent arguing about which will hit hardest first. Would you care to risk your opinion on that?
Good question. The point is, we can live without oil. Our ancestors have been living without oil for millions of years. But our ancestors have never lived with so much CO2 in the atmosphere as there is now. So if climate change occurs first, it's much more dangerous than peak oil. We should worry much more about climate change than about peak oil. In my opinion right now, if you want me to give you my opinion, I am more afraid of climate change because I see things happening very fast and too fast for me.
Ugo Bardi, I can't help worrying that we haven't really asked the right questions yet about the relationships between fossil fuel availability and climate change. What needs a lot of research and discussion, do you think?
There is always something to be researched. We never arrive to a complete understanding of anything. Some people say the science is settled. No, there's never. Science is never settled. The problem is that we cannot wait longer. We cannot wait until we have the perfect knowledge of everything. Otherwise, we will wait forever and we will do nothing.
What are you working on lately?
Oh, well, I'm working on models. I'm trying to understand what's going to happen. It's a very fascinating subject, that to studying the future. Because the future, it's something that you can study. You can never really predict it, but you can study it. You can make models, and then if you have good models, the future never really surprises you. That's the utility of models. It's not that you can know exactly what's going to happen, but you are prepared for what is going to happen, and that's what I'm working on.
Do you have a website or two you want to recommend for English listeners, and maybe also one or two for people who listen in other languages?
Yeah, my site is called Cassandra, as you may imagine from what I'm saying. It's called Cassandra's Legacy, and if you look in Google or Ugo Bardi and Cassandra, then you find me easily, and that's a point where I discuss these things. in English, and I have also a site with the same name, Cassandra in Italian, so if you can read Italian. And so the job of the Cassandra sometimes is boring because you know that what you say will not be believed. So that's sort of boring that you know that you speak to people who don't listen. But it's also very interesting because you discover things that many people don't suspect. And even Cassandras have followers, people who believe them.
As we finish up, is there a final thought you want to leave with us?
Well, that's the point. I think the crucial point of the future for humankind will be believing in Cassandra.
This is Radio EcoShock. You've been listening to Ugo Bardi. He's a professor of chemistry at the University of Florence. He researches both peak oil and climate change, and he's recently published the book, The Limits to Growth Revisited. Ugo, thank you for spending time with us.
Thanks to you. It was a pleasure.
Find more links to Ugo Bardi and this discussion in our show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. That's it. We're out of time. Find a link to download the whole hour-long ASPO 2011 presentation by Jeff Rubin and Charles Maxwell, including the Q&A, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. I have links to ASPO USA there and the 2011 conference. Download this show, the interviews, and all our past programs as free MP3s at our website, ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening, and let's meet again next week.
With a little bit of fun in trying to combine some questions, we have a question about preemptive war on Canada. to get oil sands before the Chinese get it. But it's also to get a little bit more specific, would either one of you predict closing of borders, shifting of oil from U.S. to China, military conflict that might force the question? And not military conflict, not necessarily between our two best friends, but other military instability. I'm not sure if it's your area of expertise, but economics
leads
war.
We are considering allowing a Chinese naval base on Lake Ontario. And that's because whether the Keystone XL pipeline gets approved or not, that's not where the flow of Canadian oil is going to be, because oil is going to flow to where it gets the highest price, and where it gets the highest price is where demand is greatest. I took my son fishing this summer off the North BC coast. It's quite a different landscape than the bog around Fort McMurray. And I did that because I know that in the next couple of years there's going to be Chinese super tankers going in that area, and they're not going to be there for the Chinook run. Our oil is going to go to China, and increasingly that is going to be the demand that's going to allow the oil sands or tar sands to go to 1.5 to 3 million to 3.5 million. And as you know, China's not particularly fussed about the carbon trail that's coming off that. And that's going to be a huge seismic change, because I'm sure, as Charlie can tell you, you know, Calgary, the compass is always pointed to Houston. And that's changing. 7-8 years ago, the notion of a PetroChina or a Sinopec being able to buy into Syncrude, that wasn't kosher in Alberta, okay? There's no Alberta government that would have permitted that. Believe me, the goalposts have moved in the last 6 to 7 years, and I think that if you look at what's happening in that sector, Sinopec and PetroChina did not invest $20 billion in the tar sands so more oil can flow to Cushion.
Okay, please thank our speakers.
But, you know, for someone like me, I don't really care. If you can burn it, it's good enough for me, and probably for most folk as well.